a magazine committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight, where listeners like you produce your own program. This airtime is a free service offered to those interested in sharing their knowledge, talent, and passions. This is also a space to audition new programming. Opinions expressed in Open Journal may not reflect the views of the Pacifica Foundation, its staff, board, or volunteers. Information shared on Open Journal should not take the place of appropriate professional consultation. Now it's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight here on KPFT Houston.
Good morning. This is KPFT Houston. The current time is 9:30 a.m. My name is Sabah Sarwar, and you are listening to Open Think Global, Act Local on KPFT's Open Journal Community Spotlight. And my wonderful guest is David Barsamian. And we are talking about him today.
Good morning, Sabah.
It's wonderful to have you on air. Wonderful to have you as the guest, as opposed to the other way around. You've interviewed my sister, and you know my whole family, and you hung out in my house in Karachi, and here you are again. You come to Houston often, but it's wonderful to actually have you on air. For those of you who don't know, David Barsamian is in town to speak tonight at 7 p.m. at the Houston Institute for Culture. That is located at 708 C Telephone Road. Don Sanders will be performing the music. And Wally James from Progressive Radio set up this visit, and we're very grateful to Wally. David, of course, also serves on Voices Breaking Boundaries advisory board, and I am the artistic director, co-founder of Voices Breaking Boundaries, so it was a perfect fit. And to get more information about David's visit tonight, you can go to vbbarts.org or get in touch with Wally through Progressive Radio. David is also longtime known on KPFT, obviously. He runs alternative radio. The times for the show have shifted many times. Currently, it runs at 5 a.m. on Thursday mornings. Alternative Radio is 30 years old and has been airing on KPFT since its inception. Now, David has talked, you know, if you Google David Barsamian, his last name, I'm not going to spell it to the KPFT audience. There's no way. You can Google David Barsamian and you can come up with so many different things. He's worked with Edward Said, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn. And tonight he will be actually releasing and signing a new book called Power Systems that he has worked on with Noam Chomsky. And after his talk, there will be a book signing. So definitely come and hang out. There will be beer also tonight, by the way, donated by a local brewery, St. Arnold's, that supports Voices Breaking Boundaries. So you can come, hang out, party, visit. There will be all kinds of cool people. And a big shout out and a thank you to Mark Lacey at the Houston Institute for Culture, who is always open and available to host cool events and productions. But David has an Iqbal Ahmed, of course, you've worked with, who was my professor. I don't know if you know that. So we'll talk about that some other time, not on air today.
At Hampshire,
yes. Mm. I was at Mount Holyoke, so I used to take the bus across. Oh, you knew? Mm. Oh, wow. So I guess this information sticks. But, you know, today, instead of talking about David's work, because he will be talking about that tonight, and of course you won't miss it. You will all be there tonight. It is free, open to the public, 7 o'clock. David interviews everybody, but we don't often talk about his life. You can Google him and find some stuff, but not that often. So David Barsamian was born in New York. His parents fled what is not really Armenia, but Turkey, and where his grandparents were killed. Three of his grandparents were killed during the genocide, that one of the waves of genocide. And he lives in, currently, he lives in Boulder, Colorado, from where he produces alternative radio. There he has a daughter. And I don't know much about his partner, so today we're going to talk about David's life. And I guess one of the first things I want to ask you, David, is that when do you stop hyphenating? Do you know what I'm talking about, this whole issue of identity?
Yes, I don't use hyphenations myself. You know, I happen to be a human being first. I don't define myself by nationality. I think that's further down the list, or ethnicity for that matter. You know, I think we're planetary citizens. And in a time of enormous global eco-crises, and we can talk, I'll talk more about that this evening, which has been exacerbated and accelerated by a peculiar kind of capitalist economics that's can only be described as predatory and rapacious, constant extraction of resources. And I don't have to tell people in Texas about extraction of resources and the environmental impact that is having. So hyphenation to me is not extremely
important. So you're not Armenian American. So, but how did that happen in your family? Talk about that, because they're your parents. They fled.
Well, what happens when one is targeted for extermination, for genocide, for elimination, for cultural destruction? It actually heightens awareness of that ethnicity, because you have been singled out. I mean, this is repeated over and over again, historically, with different ethnic groups. The Armenian, mostly Christian population of Anatolia, that is to say eastern Turkey today, has been living on that land for millennia, literally for several thousand years. And it was the historical and cultural homeland of the people. And we were, or they were, it's hard to know which adjective to use, we were uprooted. Our links were severed with the land, from the churches, from the monasteries, from the libraries, from the schools. And so it was an enormous cultural shock to be displaced in that way with such violence. Of course, we know very well what happened in the Indian subcontinent in 1947.
And then 71 again.
It's been unfortunately, again, Rwanda and other places, a theme of...
But we're going to get back to you, which is, I know you're going to avoid it because you don't talk about yourself, but talk about how it was in your home in New York when you flee. I mean, how did they cross over? What led to that?
My parents were... not disrespectfully saying this, they were country bumpkins. They were not well educated at all. My father was barely literate, even in Armenian. And they really struggled, that first generation that comes to the U.S. without language skills.
Did they come on a ship?
Yeah. Okay. In those days, it was Ellis Island. That was the portal. Uh-huh. And so my parents met in Beirut in 1921. Mm-hmm. They married there. My mother was 15 or 16 years old. And they got on a boat in Beirut and went to Marseille. From Marseille, they went overland to Paris, from Paris to Cherbourg, another ship, and they came to New York. And except for a brief trip or two to Ontario, Canada, they never left the United States again.
Wow, that's amazing.
So they lived here 50, 60 years. Wow. Without leaving the country.
That's amazing. So you are, my name is Seba Sarwar. This is Think Global, Act Local. It is now 9:38 a.m. and the show is Think Global, like I just said, Think Global, Act Local. And my guest is David Barsamian, and we are talking about him and his life.
I think what is particularly important to point out in terms of my family history and just the history is that 2015 marks the 100th anniversary of this major genocide carried out, premeditated, systematic, state-sponsored genocide by the Turkish government. Now, why do I say that? To this day, despite universal acknowledgement by countries, by the UN, by all kinds of agencies and historians and scholars, the Turkish government denies the historical reality of what happened in 1915. So this is an enormous amount of pain for me and other Armenians, because there's no closure. They're telling us what happened to you didn't happen.
This is not in textbooks, history textbooks in Turkey.
Not at all. Not at
even
all.
Even now.
Important writers like Orhan Pamuk, mm-hmm. the Nobel Prize winner, and others, Elif Shafak,
yes.
They have been driven from Turkey. If they open their mouths and talk about the Armenian genocide, they risk death even. Harran Dink was murdered, a very important Turkish-Armenian journalist on the streets of Istanbul a few years ago. So it's still an extremely sensitive issue in Turkey. And I think, you know, after a century, it's high time for it to be resolved.
One century. And your grandparents, three of your grandparents were killed in 1915?
Well, my father's father, Barsam Barsamyan, was killed in a pogrom in the mid-1890s. My father was born in 1895. He never knew his father, who died in massacres then, which killed hundreds of thousands. There were preludes to the genocide.
Sure.
It just didn't happen out of the blue. So 1894, 1896, there was major massacres. There was another major massacre in 1909. And then finally, under the cover of World War I, when the Turkish government thought, well, most of the world is busy with the war, we can carry out this campaign of extermination.
Very, very.
So that was a shadow in my childhood.
And so when growing up in New York, were you in Manhattan?
Manhattan on the Upper East Side. There were very few Armenian families
in
our neighborhood.
So what did your parents do?
My father was a grocer.
Okay.
He had a grocery store right downstairs from where we lived. We lived upstairs three flights, and he was downstairs. So I could see the means of production right in front of me.
Wow. And then do you have other siblings?
Yes, I had two older brothers and a sister as well. But the genocide was a kind of shadow that informed the whole family and disinformed the whole family because it was such a rupture, it was such a cataclysmic event that they really couldn't articulate much about it. I would try and find out. My first interviews were with family members. What happened? Why did the Turks do this? What caused it? What was the historical context? There was a great reluctance to talk about it.
So, in terms of the language spoken in your home, in your apartment?
Armenian. Yeah. And we had a railroad flat. That means in those days, the tenements were walk-ups, and there were five little rooms, very long, like a railroad car.
Wow. So Armenian spoken in the apartment, and then in the railroad flat, and then English spoken outside.
Totally.
And your parents, of course, had to adopt English, or they already knew.
Not very well. They never really, you know, mastered the language, even though they, you know, lived here 50, 60 years. My mother was very involved in the church. Most Armenians are Orthodox Christians, and she was a volunteer there. She would cook and
Were there a lot of refugees? It was a strong refugee community?
There was, initially. Particularly in the 1920s, when there was a major arrival of people fleeing the Middle East. Many Armenians were driven not just from Anatolia, but they were driven into Syria, where my mother went, into Iraq, into Lebanon. There's a large Armenian community in Lebanon today. There's one in Syria today as well. But all of this was, you know, all kind of in the background, And here I was, a kid growing up as an American, you know, interested in baseball and wanting to be a center fielder for the Brooklyn Dodgers.
So how did you feel in the classroom? Did you feel like, oh, I'm just an American kid? Or was that feeling like?
I knew I was the other because it was an all-white neighborhood. It was heavily Roman Catholic, Irish, Italian, German. They had a very strong German presence in that area. In fact, the neighborhood is called Germantown, Yorkville. Today it's all changed now. There's luxury townhouses and high-rises and valet parking and underground garages and all that. So it doesn't have any of the flavor of Central Europe that it had when I was growing up. I mean, just walking down the main street, East 86th Street, you could hear German as much as English spoken because it was the link language for the Austrians, for Czechs, for Russians, for Poles.
And we're talking about the year
1950s.
And so did you feel like you had to fake being American? Like you had to, when people said, I don't know if people asked, who are you? Where do you come from?
Well, they didn't even know what Armenia was. I was constantly explaining it to people. I was being called Albanian or Argentinian. I mean, the ignorance was stupefying. And so I would, you know, and I remember my sister carrying around a map, you know, to take out and show people because, you know, Americans are not very good. The sad, in geography, the sad joke is that when the U.S. invades or bombs a country, then Americans learn about the tribal tribal areas of Pakistan.
Waziristan has now become a buzzword, right?
Yeah.
So you're listening to Think Global, Act Local. My name is Seba Sarwar, and I'm interviewing David Barsamian, and we shall be right back.
And here is a quick look at traffic and weather. No accidents to report currently, and there's just one area of slow traffic, and that's on the 610 West Loop, southbound from I-10, Katy Freeway to Westheimer. That travel time is close to 6 minutes. The current temperature is 49 degrees. Skies are overcast. Humidity is 80%. There's a 60% chance of showers today, otherwise cloudy with a high of 50 degrees and a low of 36 degrees. Air quality is in the good range. And now back to today's Community Spotlight, Think Global, Act Local, with Seba Sarwar and her guest, David Barsamian.
It's wonderful to have you. And, you know, we could talk for hours, and we will visit more after. But I guess I'm interested in just jumping a little bit. We're talking about New York, Manhattan in the 50s, and now I'm going to jump to now. And, of course, I have a vested interest. You have a daughter who's 11 years old. Who is your partner? Talk about her and then talk. And then your daughter, does she hyphenate? How does she identify herself?
She's not hyphenated. She's very much American. She was born to Turkish parents. Both her parents are from Ankara. So my wife, I got married about 4 years ago. She's my stepdaughter, mm-hmm. and her name is Kyra. My wife's name is Kadriye, uh-huh. and politically we're very much on the same web page, as it were. And Kyra is, you know, precocious, bright, extremely literate and verbal and sassy.
What a surprise!
And shows me how to use my smartphone, which. I wonder why they call it a smartphone, because I feel dumb when I look at this thing and can't figure anything out. And I hand it to Kyra, and she, oh, listen, Dodo, this is what you have to do. Press this button, do this.
But where was she born? In this country?
She was born in Boulder.
In Boulder. So, but your wife was born in Ankara.
Ankara, yeah.
So, you know, like my daughter was born in Houston, but I am very much from Pakistan. And my husband is from the valley, from the U.S.-Mexico valley. So when she introduces herself, she'll usually say, well, I was born in Houston, but I'm also from Pakistan. I'm also from, you know, the border of, you know, she has that. Does your daughter articulate that? Does that matter to her?
Yeah, it might not. She's bilingual. Her mother talks to her in Turkish. She knows a few Armenian words.
That's great.
And, you know, I often curse in multiple languages. So that's one of the virtues of doing live radio, because, you know, you don't want to be sued by the FCC for saying something in English that can be intelligible. So I learned very early in my radio career, when the mic is on, be careful about what you're saying.
So, and have you gone to Turkey with her?
Yes, several times.
How was that experience for you? Because here you are partnered with a Turk.
Yes.
And then the history of your family with the Turks.
It's an odd situation in that I feel somewhat like a cultural relic there. When people relate to me, they don't really know how to talk to an Armenian that has been dispossessed from their land and from a government that continues to deny that ever happened. And so there's it's an odd feeling, the vibration. You know, when I look at people in the street, sometimes it looks like I'm seeing my relatives. Mm-hmm. Did they convert to Islam in order to avoid persecution and probably death and deportation, for sure? It's hard to say. There's this shadow cast over Turkey by this unresolved issue. And again, I think 2015 is the perfect opportunity to resolve this once and for all and to settle the matter so that we can move forward.
Are there people in Turkey who are working on this? Because in Palestine, there are, you know, very progressive Israelis who are working on trying to resolve what is happening. And in Pakistan, there are people who are addressing the Bangladesh issue. I mean, there are always progressive forces, yeah? There must
yes,
be.
Yes, the historical treatment of the Armenians, and they continue to be discriminated against in Turkey today, but it's a small community. There might be 50,000 or so, but there are many more who are called hidden Armenians. Like they had converted to Islam, but they really practice their language and customs undercover, as it were. And we saw that in Spain and Portugal, even in the southwest of the United States, where people converted to Catholicism but kept their, you know, indigenous traditions.
So is this, you know, and of course I know you from multiple places, but of course I know that I was thinking about cursing in some Urdu with you on air because you also speak Urdu and you spent 10 years in New Delhi practicing, learning the sitar. And that was in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
So what led you? No, I want to know what prompted you to go there.
Well, it was a
here you are, Armenian.
Yes.
Growing up in Manhattan, and you go off to New Delhi.
I'm going to give you the quick bio description.
Yes, because we have 1 minute.
Right. I was madly in love with a Hungarian refugee
in San Francisco. I didn't know this.
And I could not figure out how to resolve this relationship with her. She was 10 years older than I, and I didn't want to get bogged down. I was only 18 or 19. And so I went down to the Norwegian Seamen's Union in San Francisco, right near the clock tower there, and lied my way aboard a ship saying I had experience. And when the captain there said, well, what's your experience? I said, where are your papers? I said, well, last time I was in Hong Kong, I got jumped and my papers were stolen. What was the name of your ship? I said, Viking Star, because he was Norwegian. I think he was so impressed by my arrogance and bravado that he said, okay, I'm hiring you.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it was ridiculous. And so I worked my way across the Pacific. I jumped ship in Japan. I traveled throughout Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Thailand, Cambodia.
And you were all of 18 years old.
18, 19, yeah. I get to India in 1966, and by this time I'm 21 or so. I get sick. My travel plans get disrupted because I got hepatitis, I got dysentery, I got an ear infection.
That happens.
Yeah,
all of those things. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. My name is Seba Sarwar. It's 9:51, and I'm talking to David Barsamian, and I think you need to continue with this story.
So My travel plans are disrupted. I stay in India to recover. By coincidence, I run into who is to be my teacher, Pandit Debu Chaudhary, a very well-known sitar maestro. He's a disciple of Ustad Mushtaq Ali Khan, the Senior Gharana. These are like... huge, you know, mega stars. I mean, really. Classical Indian music is very highly developed. It's, you know, it also continues, when I say that, in Pakistan as well in different shapes and forms. So I was privileged to learn from some of the greatest musicians on the face of the earth. You know, I heard, if anyone knows who Vilayat Khan is, the sitar player, amazing. It's like being in the presence of Mozart or Beethoven. That's the level of virtuosity and genius that I was exposed to. So even though I'm not a practicing sitar player today, it informs everything I do because I was exposed to excellence. And no matter what kind of excellence you're exposed to, be it cooking, sewing, embroidery, radio interviewing, it brings you up and you can do other things. And so one of the lessons I learned from another one of my teachers, his name was Ustad Asad Ali Khan. He played the Rudra Bina, the Rudra Bin. He said, always learn one thing really well. Then you'll be able to do lots of things. But if you try and do lots of things at once, you wind up doing nothing well. So being in the company, in the mahal, in the atmosphere of these great master musicians, ustad and pandits, was for me my education.
So as you were learning the sitar,
I was learning Urdu, Hindi, Bengali, poetry.
You were in Delhi.
Yeah, I was in Delhi, but I was being exposed to all of this extremely rich culture. North India is an amalgam of civilizations, of cultures, of languages.
We won't talk about what happened in North India. We won't even go there today because...
That's another program.
That's another program. What happened to you most recently because of the changes that are happening in India. But in terms of the language, how have you been able to retain it? Because we can talk in Urdu and your Urdu is way higher than mine.
No, I wouldn't say that. Well, I just gravitated to the language. It's a composite language with lots of Prakrit, Hindi dialect, and Persian influences, Farsi, Arabic, even some Turkish words.
10 years.
Less than that, 5 years.
Why did I think 10?
I don't know.
What brought you back?
The FBI, the CIA. I was being hounded by the U.S. government to return to the United States. This is the time of the Vietnam War. I was being threatened with indictment. I was called into the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi, and I met the agent in charge, the CIA agent, who warned me that if I didn't return to the United States as quickly as possible, I risk being indicted.
What?
And prosecuted.
Why?
Because at that time there was a mandatory draft.
Oh, that's right, of course.
And I was considered a draft dodger.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I wasn't anxious to support what was an absolutely criminal war in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. And so I did everything I could to resist that, but I wanted to avoid being indicted. So I returned to New York. I got in touch with, before I left India, I got a letter from a doctor saying I was crazy as a result of living in India. I got to New York. The ACLU put me in touch with a doctor who said, David
yes,
is crazy.
Crazy.
He is crazy.
Pagale, pagale.
He cannot perform in any kind of stressful situation. You know, he's extremely fragile and delicate. And then I took the exam and I managed to get 4F, which was the designation unfit under any circumstances to serve in the U.S. military. It's a designation I'm proud of.
It's interesting to think about what would have happened, what your journey would have been had you not been forced out of India. Where would you imagine yourself just staying there? Was that something that... And did it help you forget the Hungarian?
Oh, yes, yes. I got beyond her, for sure.
So you achieved your goal in
yes.
that. But would you have stayed, you think?
It's hard to say. I mean, I really love being there, and I have more friends there than I do in the United States, even today. You know, Arundhati Roy, Sanjay Kak, Hirsch Dobal, lots of journalist friends, musicians. It's, you know, it's a second home to me, and I was deported from India in September of 2011, and I haven't been allowed back in the country.
That is really, really terrible. So you can hear more from David Barsamian tonight at 7 p.m. He will be speaking at the Houston Institute for Culture, which is located 708C Telephone Road. Go to vbbarts.org for more information on the KPFT website. He will be speaking Power Systems, a book with Noam Chomsky, and there will be a book signing. And I think he will be taking questions so we can continue down this path of his personal life and ask him more questions.
You have been listening to Open Journal, KPFT's experiment in community-inspired radio. Since 1970, KPFT has been a unique source on the Houston airwaves. We rely on listener donations. Visit kpft.org to support this station. KPFT listener members are welcome to produce an Open Journal. Prospective producers must fill out an Open Journal request form, which is available at our website with details. The program director welcomes your feedback on every Open Journal. Listener feedback helps KPFT determine what Open Journals are appreciated by the community at large. To get in touch with the program director, send an email to pd@kpft.org or call 713-526-4000, extension 308. Please stay tuned for Wide Open Spaces coming up at 10, and thank you for tuning in to today's Open Journal here on 90.1 KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
This is Bird Note. It won't be long before North America's largest swallows, purple martins, will be looking for places to nest. They'll be arriving from as far away as Venezuela and Brazil. In eastern North America, where most martins breed, they nest almost exclusively in human-made houses. In the west, they also raise their young in natural cavities and woodpecker holes. The birds need specially designed communal houses, as well as adequate open space where they can hunt flying insects. They prefer nest boxes mounted on poles 10 to 17 feet high and at least 30 feet away from human homes. Also, martins may not colonize their new sites unless recordings of calls are broadcast to attract them. Providing housing is important because purple martins are decreasing significantly in some regions. Populations have declined by more than 50% in Florida and in the upper Midwest. Why?
It's likely from the loss of natural cavities and suitable habitat, and increased competition for the nest sites from European starlings and house sparrows. So if you put up communal nest boxes for purple martins, place them near open water, and plug the entrances to keep out invaders until the martins arrive in spring. You'll find a link to the Purple Martin Conservation Association on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.